Extra, extra, read all about it.
RandomChatter.com presents...
Agent Carter, you are going to run S.H.I.E.L.D.
Agent Carter of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files.
I go to work.
With your hosts, Directors Shepard and Stolte.
You boys play nice.
I have orders for Agent Carter.
Calling all junior agents of the Strategic Scientific Reserve. It's now time for Agent Carter of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files, brought to you by Max Factor's Hollywood Makeup, the screen star secret that beautifies instantly. I'm Station Chief Shepard.
And I'm Station Chief Stolte.
And today we bring you the continuing adventures of Peggy Carter as she fights for truth, justice, and equal pay. Join us each and every week as we marvel at Agent Carter and show you that we're in the know. Well, welcome back, everybody. Whether you're living in the mid-20th century or the early 21st century, we'd like to welcome you back to Agent Carter of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files on our second go-around here. So we are excited to be back. It's been a long break. We haven't had any Agent Carter episodes for, 9 months, I guess.
It's been a very long time. For a while, we weren't even sure if we were going to get any more.
That is true. That is true. We are glad we got them. We knew Peggy was going to be showing up in things. Showed up in Ant-Man last summer. I think she showed up in another episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. last year. And there is talk about her potentially being in Captain America Civil War in some fashion, either above or below ground. So we might have that to look forward to. But right now... you and everybody else here gets a chance to enjoy 10 episodes of Agent Carter airing on ABC this winter. And that's two more than we had last year. So we got a great start. I was very impressed by the two episodes that they kind of, you know, strung together as kind of, I guess it doesn't even really seem like a movie since they did kind of break it up with, you know, as two episodes with, you know, previously on, even on the second episode, in case you just missed what happened for, you know, an hour.
I think they just pre-prepare those so they can just throw it on the DVD when it comes out, you know?
Probably.
Well, but, I like you, I was pleasantly surprised that they just jumped right in. It was great. I felt like they didn't really have to set up the characters this time and the setting this time around because... obviously we kind of watched it last season. I would guess most people did, but they didn't waste time on that. You know,
we got right into the mysteries. We got right into the action and everything. But you know what? I think we're getting a little bit of ahead of ourselves here.
We are. Hold on. I've got my singlet on. I'm ready to discuss all the interesting news and talking about this. I've been practicing my judo, so I'm ready when you are.
Oxford rules, of course.
Of course.
So why don't you tell us the names of the very long names of the two episodes that we got here this week?
Okay, so because it did, to me, felt kind of like a two-hour movie, you know, even though it was broken up, I kind of chunked this all together. So I'll tell you the details about
both. Well, we're going to talk about it as kind of one big episode, not really as the two discrete episodes. Because, I mean, there were some questions that got raised in that first part that were answered, you know, pretty immediately in the second part. So, yeah.
Yep.
That's fine. I like what you did here.
The first episode or first half of the movie premiere here was called The Lady in the Lake. Both these episodes aired January 19th, 2016. But the first episode was written by Brant Engelstein and directed by Lawrence Trilling. And then the second part we got was A View in the Dark. It was written by Eric Pearson and Lindsay Allen, directed by Lawrence Trilling.
That name sounds really familiar.
Which one?
Wait, he directed the first episode, that's why.
Yes, right. Same director, different writer, so.
Yeah, so, excellent.
Now, Agent Peggy Carter has returned in exciting fashion as she begins her new adventures taking down Dorothy Underwood. But you know what? She can't even tie up those loose ends before she's called out to Los Angeles to help Daniel Souza, who is now the director of the West Coast SSR. And they want to know why the dead girl they found was frozen in a block of ice in a frozen lake during the middle of a heat wave. Mm. So it turns out she was exposed to zero matter. That's the name of it. I don't mean like
zero matter.
No matter. Yeah, zero matter. Sounds like a punk band. A substance. That substance was discovered by this company called Isodyne, who I think also discovered the Terminator. Was that? No, I may be thinking.
No, that was Cyberdyne.
Cyberdyne. Okay, yeah, they branched out later on in the late 20th century. But anyway, this Isodyne company here, with the help of a corrupt senator, they want to use this zero matter to get rich off of its power potential.
Yeah, well, it's and he's not quite a senator. What are you, a campaigning senator, I guess?
I guess, yeah, like a wannabe senator,
a mayor.
A politician. He was a politician. Wait, he was just a mayor?
No.
Is that all? You were just guessing. Okay. All right. Anyway, it's a politician guy. Yeah, whatever.
Maybe governor, I guess.
They all look the same to me. I don't know. I can't tell. anyway, this politician, what was his name? Now,
is that Calvin Chadwick.
It's Calvin Chadwick. That's right. He wants to get rich off of this stuff, this zero matter. At least that's what it appeared to be. I'm still wondering if that was their only plan with this stuff. But this conspiracy here, it goes deep and it spreads wide. Hopefully, Carter, Sousa, and Jarvis can get the help from the Isodyne scientist known as Dr. Wilkes, who Peggy seems to be getting along with just smashingly. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
However, we may have counted on him a little bit too much, since he and the seemingly even more corrupt politician's wife there, and Hollywood starlet, get caught up in an explosion caused by the zero matter. So now Carter's going to have to use her wits and skills, of course, to make everything right. And she only has a few short episodes to do it.
Well, two more episodes than last season, so... but since they got off to such a rollicking start... I have to say, I like these two episodes as a premiere for the character much more than I enjoyed the season one premiere episodes, because I felt, again, me personally, just such a fan of the Marvel Cinematic Universe and stuff, and having seen the Agent Carter short, I felt I kind of knew who this character was. Now, of course, they were introducing us, to Jarvis and Thompson and Dooley and Sousa and everybody else. The first episodes last season, but this just, I don't know. This is, let's just get in and do it, and we'll get to some of that character stuff later, which is kind of what they did in these episodes. They start off with a really great action sequence. But before we, I'm so excited I want to talk about this. Before we do that, let's just talk about a couple a couple pieces of news here that have come across the wire in between our Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. case files podcast and this one. So I think we might have talked about this at the very end of the first half of the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. season, but ABC finally went ahead and ordered a pilot for Marvel's Most Wanted, which is the on-again, off-again show, a spinoff show from S.H.I.E.L.D. with Lance Hunter and Bobby Morse. So keep an eye out for that, because that potentially could be a third series on from the Marvel Cinematic Universe on ABC coming next season. So we will, of course, give you more information on that as soon as we find out about that. Also, there was a news report about how the Inhumans that have been showing up in S.H.I.E.L.D. may not really be connected with the movie, the Inhumans movie that's coming out in, 2019, I guess, here. So, I've discussed this a little bit on our Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast. So, I never thought that really that the Inhumans that we see in the movie are going to have direct ties to these characters, like Lincoln isn't going to show up, in the movie or something like that. And, we're probably going to see more of the comic book style Inhumans, your Black Bolt and Medusa and Crystal and Lockjaw and stuff like that in the film. And we're getting the more kind of, grounded, down to earth Inhumans. Now, there may be, of course, references, but, they're not necessarily.
And that's, we had talked about, because it was so far out, the movie, from what we were seeing in Inhumans on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., that they might,
it's like 4 years.
Yeah, that they might not get to that. But It seems like they established a storyline for these Inhumans, but I'm not even sure that they're going to follow that much anymore. So,
well, I mean, for me, it's and this is something else I remember us talking about in season two with Jia Ying's group, was that, you know, they were kind of an outcast group of Inhumans. So even if there is to be another group of Inhumans, you know, this the royal family or whatever, there's no reason that there has to be any reference to, you know, these other groups that we're seeing on on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So either way, I'm kind of bummed that we do have to wait, well, you know, probably 3.5 years at this point until that movie comes out. But the good news is there's, you know, for fans of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, a lot of cool stuff coming in between, including an Ant-Man sequel, a Guardians of the Galaxy sequel, the new Captain America, Doctor Strange, the Infinity War movies, Captain Marvel's movie. We've got Deadpool kind of over there on the other side at Fox and the new X-Men films.
In the back room of the comic book shop?
Yeah, behind the curtain. Yeah. So I got to say, I'm not a huge Deadpool fan as far as the comics go, but I'm really interested to see this movie. So
I am too. I am too.
Even though it's not Marvel Cinematic Universe per se, but that's cool. And then for fans of comics, if you guys on Wednesdays like to go out and get your new comic books, or, you know, Thursdays or on the weekend, whenever you go to your comic shop, if you hadn't seen it already, there is a new Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. comic book. So this takes place in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but it follows the adventures of the characters from the show. So it's got Coulson, and it's got Mockingbird is a big part of it, but it's also got Fitz and Simmons, and it kind of picks up where the old S.H.I.E.L.D. Series had left off. First issue came out last week, so you're not that far behind, and it's a monthly title at this point, so check that out. It's pretty interesting. And you know, that's some of the things that are going on. If there's other things about S.H.I.E.L.D. that we find out about, or Agent Carter specifically, we will bring those up as we continue on for the, I'm assuming, for the next 9 weeks. But scheduling is a little messed up since Agent Carter started about 2 weeks later than they wanted to. I know they really wanted to start at the beginning of January, but then they held off for 2 weeks due to the fact that President Obama had his State of the Union last week, and that would have preempted the show. So they decided not to show their premiere, take a week off, and then come back to the show. So we'll see how this, you know, as we get closer to March, there's still a kind of a firm date for that S.H.I.E.L.D. Mid-season premiere.
Am I recalling correctly that last year they combined the two finale episodes of Agent Carter?
Yes, I believe so. It was, two premiere episodes.
Maybe they'll do something like that to at least catch 1 week up or something there. I don't know.
Yeah, they'd be able to get one week closer, but, other than that, I don't really know. So, anyway, we'll keep you updated on the schedule, but at this point it looks like Agent Carter will be airing one episode every week. Oh, and also, I don't know if you saw it yet. I hadn't had a chance to watch it yet, but right before Agent Carter came on, there was a Captain America 75 Heroic Years special on ABC that celebrated him.
Now,
how was that?
It was, you know what? I mean, I guess I don't know if I'm one to tell everyone the quality of the programming, because I really liked it, but I am
like
really
everything.
Not. I do like everything. I'm pretty easy to please, actually. But it was really just what it said. It was a history of Captain America from the comics all the way up through basically up to Civil War. It was, you know, pretty much just a commercial for Civil War, really. But but not being really knowledgeable about the history of Captain America, I was really interested in it. I was really fascinated about his origins and why they wrote him and how he really had to adapt to the culture of our country as they were developing this character. And there were times throughout the history of our country because of, you know, whatever political, economic, you know, wartime reasons that he wasn't as popular, and just the opposite. There were times that he was wildly popular. I learned a lot that I didn't know about before I watched it, and now I'm really excited about Civil War. Well, actually, I was really excited about Civil War before, but it kind of set it up for me. So anyway, I thought it was really good. If you get a chance to catch it, it's fun.
Well, the thing that I always find amazing is that, you know, in 1941, I guess, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby created Captain America, had him as this comic book, you know, he was a comic book character that was being published during World War II, famously punching out Hitler on the cover of his first or second issue, mm-hmm. I guess. And then, like you said, the war finished, and he became not very popular. He kind of went away. His book became, like, Captain America's Weird Tales or something like that, and then just became Weird Tales, and it went away. And then when Marvel Comics started up in the early to mid-60s, Stan Lee is like, oh, you know, I'm going to bring Captain America back in the Avengers. And they kind of wrote it in that he had been alive during World War II in the Marvel Universe and frozen in ice and, you know, resurrected and everything like that. And, you know, they had Jack Kirby working on this character again. It's like, I mean, how many times do you just create a character that is popular, goes away, and then, you know, like 20 years later, they resurrect him and like you're asked, hey, you want to come back and, you know, work on the book again? It's like, that's, you know,
it was very interesting for, even if you're not a comic book person, I thought the history of him and the stories that they wrote for him was really just kind of fascinating, you know? I mean, it really talked a lot to our, I was going to say our kids for different generations, but I don't think it's just kids. I think it's just American citizens in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well, hey, you know, we're not here to talk specifically about Captain America. Let's talk about his true love, Margaret Peggy Carter.
His main squeeze.
Yes. And they never did get that dance. So we open this episode with a nice, I thought it was a pretty concise, like 2 minute retelling of what happened in season one. Now, granted, it kind of just hit a lot of the high notes. But, you know, we found out kind of who Peggy Carter was. You know, someone, she knows her worth, and she was fighting against, you know, all this oppression of the male dominated society, but she seemed to make her own way by the end of the first series. And we had seen her walking around, you know, that opening shot from the first episode of season one with the red hat and the blue suit. And so we get that same opening with the blue suit and the red hat, but it turns out that it's actually Dottie Underwood, which I thought was a really clever twist on that whole opening. So, you know, we kind of join Peggy in the middle of consider it a sting operation, since I think pretty much everybody in the bank appeared to be an SSR agent, you know, that they were just out to get Dottie. She's trying to steal this secret organization's pin from a specific lockbox, and then we got that brilliant slow motion shot of Peggy hitting her in the back of the head with a bag of quarters or something, like, you know, some coinage, and it's spilling all over. So I thought that was a really great way to open the series up to reintroduce a couple characters, show that, you know, Dottie is still around, because as we left her, she fell out a two-story window onto a plane and was bleeding, but, you know, we knew she got away. So, did that really strike you? Did that help get you back into the mood for the series, Josh?
It actually surprised me that's how it started, with her, and they were still in New York, and just because I had seen all the promos and everything and saw that it was in LA. So, I thought they were going to jump right into LA. So, it almost felt like it ended just very shortly after, season one ended. And then they very quickly established how she was going to get to LA and started moving on. So yeah, I liked that. And I also kind of was surprised how they set up, you know, her, I guess her nemesis, because I didn't realize, or maybe they didn't either, but I didn't know that they were going to make those two so connected, I guess, mm-hmm. you know, because she was, as she was talking to, what's his name? Thompson. You know, as he was interrogating her and she was just kind of toying
Chief
with
Thompson
him.
That's Chief Thompson to you.
yeah, sorry, Chief. But she was kind of toying with him because she really wanted to deal more with Peggy, you know? And So now they've got this weird kind of, you know, connection where she's her main nemesis.
It's cool. And I like the parallels that they've kind of set up between these two characters that, I mean, Dottie really feels a strong connection to Peggy. And I think, you know, Peggy wants to prove herself because, as Thompson pointed out, you know, some spy you are, you know, this woman lived next door to you for however long and you didn't realize that anything was going on. And I think that burns her a little bit. So I too like the fact that they started in New York. I'm not against it, but, you know, a lot of times in television, in between seasons, you know, there's a change that has taken place. I'm for whatever reason, I'm thinking more about, like, you know, sitcoms specifically, like all of a sudden there's new characters that are introduced into the sitcom family, or the sitcom takes place in a different location, or, you know, or they've moved houses or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And they don't really do any kind of setup. It's just, this is how this season's going to be. And they don't really talk about it. It just, this is the new way that it works. And we'll continue on for this.
So, like, all of a sudden, Samantha from Bewitched is married to a completely different man. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yes. Something like that. Or Cousin Oliver shows up.
Yeah. Well, and you can tell some time has taken place.
Sure.
Just, I mean, because, you know, you got Sousa out in California now, and clearly he didn't just go there and set the whole thing up overnight. So, you know, it's probably been a few months.
Yeah, he said he'd been there for a few months or something like that.
Right.
So, but I like that they, you know, they were teasing. It's like, hey, Los Angeles. All the promos were like, she's in L.A. and she's an L.A. woman and all this kind of stuff. But the fact that they didn't just start in Los Angeles, I appreciate that. And that's what I kind of like about this show from season one is it moves at its own pace. Now, that pace has really picked up in this season, but it didn't just start in Los Angeles. Continued in New York. A nice continuation of the storyline where we were in season one. And it still wasn't even a really quick move. It was like there was interrogation scenes. We found out that Sousa was in L.A. Then Peggy got called out. But it still, you know, there was still stuff going on. And it, I don't know, what took us 15 or 20 minutes to actually get out to Los Angeles, which was fine. And then, you know, boom, we've got Peggy and Jarvis reunited. And the... I missed probably, I'm going to say, like 50% of the dialogue the first time through on these episodes between them, because I'm laughing at the previous joke and they're already moving on to something else.
Very fast-paced banter.
The banter. Yeah, the banter was incredible. I was really, really enjoying it. And just all of Jarvis's innuendo, Peggy's continued disgust at Howard Stark and his lifestyle is just, it's a never ending smorgasbord of humor there. You know,
well, and I think that is one thing that really stands out in this show is it's not a comedy, but they've got this banter that they're using for the humor aspect of it. I mean, unless you have a high drama television show, you got to throw some humor in there because that's how real life is. I mean, you know, you joke around in real life. Mm-hmm. But I think that makes this show kind of stand out in a way from even Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Oh, yeah. Well, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has got some funny stuff in it, but this... So Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., because it's a modern show, it adheres to kind of modern... The way that the dialect is handled is more modern. For this, because you've got the two leads in it with Peggy and Jarvis being Brits, and I think the showrunners are really trying to take the thematic of American 1940s film, just in general. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm kind of thinking like, you know, Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell and stuff like that, and just kind of fast-paced
like
dialogue.
Dialogue from the I didn't even think about that.
There's that stylistic element of it.
It is
there.
Very much like that.
Besides the language that they use, it's also the nature of the dialogue. And then added on to it this season is they've gone for a real a noir vibe because they're out in Los Angeles in the 40s. They said they looked at a lot of stuff, including Chinatown, which is a more modern film, as well as L.A. Confidential, which are modern takes on old Los Angeles, as well as films that were shot and take place in Los Angeles from, you know, the 30s and 40s. Most notably, if you watch, like when I was watching it the second time, I realized how many times there are Venetian blinds that characters are being lit through, walking down hallways or in rooms where there's just the shadow, the slat shadow going across their
I got to go back and look for that specifically. I love things like that.
I was just going to say, I think the humor stems from that aspect of it.
I agree completely.
You know, it's part of the DNA of the style that they're going for, as well mm-hmm. as something that they're trying to, again, like you said, set this show apart from other shows, including Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
And I want to just quickly to wrap this part up. I think that it's being done more successfully here in Los Angeles than it was last season in New York, which I also like that movies of that genre set in New York during that time. I think it's a completely different feel, different atmosphere in New York than Los Angeles, obviously. But it didn't feel as natural last season as it does already this season, and just in the first two episodes.
And that could be any number of things, from the actors being more comfortable, writers having a freer hand,
or the fact that it's probably filmed in Los Angeles, even the New York ones too, right?
Even the New York scenes were shot in LA. Yeah, that's true. So, so we've got Dottie Underwood as, well, she's in custody of the SSR, but then quickly she is taken into custody by the FBI. So I was going to say she's kind of still out there roaming around, but we'll be circling around this entire issue, because I think that that she probably will be around for more of the episodes than just these two. So we've got this mysterious organization. There's a pin that they find in the vault that was in, I don't know, I think it was like number 143 or something like that. And she was trying to steal it for somebody, and, you know, they're asking questions. We see this pin on a number of other characters in episode 2, I believe. It was the first time we saw those. So for people that have been watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., this, the logo on the pin, which to me, Josh, I would describe it as kind of, it's a, like a gold circle stick pin with sort of a stylized A on it. Is that... It's like, or an upside down V of some kind.
Yep.
That's kind of what it looks like, right?
Absolutely. Yep. I've got it drawn right here on my notes, and that's exactly what I drew.
For people watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., that should look very familiar. It to me, at least, it does. So my question is this mysterious organization, this society that is on here, is this supposed to be Hydra?
That is a good question. The short answer is I don't know, and so is the long answer.
Okay. Oh, are you just a lab tech now?
Always.
I'll invite you out for drinks later, I promise.
Oh, thank you. No, it feels to me as if that's what they're going for, because it fits with so much of what we've learned in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. This season about the origins of Hydra. And this, the symbol... if the zero matter didn't do it, the symbol, it kind of cemented it for me. I think that this is it's just the only thing that was a little I guess not confusing, because like when we say origins, they talked a lot in the last few episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. about how Hydra is a lot older than people think, and it was before it was even really Hydra. So yeah. I don't know about it being the origin, but I definitely think it's a, you know, part of the evolution of Hydra, what we're seeing here.
Got it. So when they're asking Dottie about, you know, why she stole this, was she trying to sell it or something like that, she says that there are currencies stronger than money. I, for the life of me, am like kicking this around in my head, and I can't really put this one together. Do you have any thoughts about what she may be referring to, other than just in terms of saying something kind of mysterious about, you know, people who have power that is more important than money, I guess? I don't know.
I think power is kind of part of what she's talking about, is like being in this organization, whatever we're going to call it, we'll say Hydra.
I have a name. According to the producers, it is called the Council of Nine.
That's lame. No wonder they changed it to Hydra. The con.
Yeah. A bunch of white old guys. I mean, come on. We know they're not really creative. So.
That's what they have on their bowling shirts, right? CO9.
Maybe Jerry Ryan's going to show up later as one of the council members.
Yeah, I think so.
She would be seven of the Council of Nine.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I think, you know, power is one big thing, but also items, you know, such as this. We don't really know specifically what this zero matter is. I mean, I think we have our ideas, right?
From a number of different interviews with the executive producers, they've talked about the theoretical basis. I mean, what they're trying to accomplish with the zero matter, you know, which is, I don't know that it's necessarily spoilery to say that they're tying it into kind of the dark force that we saw in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. season one, as used by Blackout, and tying it into elements that will be seen in some fashion in Doctor Strange later this year.
Right. So now, that's good, by the way. Thank you for sharing that Doctor Strange stuff, because I had forgotten about that. But I just wanted to kind of tie, and I don't know. I really don't have the answer to what she was saying, but it reminded me of toward the end, when they're meeting with that Council of Nine, and they tell what's his name? Chadwick? No, Chad.
Yeah.
Chadwick.
Calvin Chadwick.
Chadwick. They tell him that they're, you know, pulling the plug on Aes Sedai and getting rid of all this. But to me, it felt like he really was doing what he said he was going to do. He wanted to make a lot of money on using this zero matter to kind of get the monopoly on a new energy, right? It seemed like that's really what – and he was really disappointed when they pulled it. But they
– I don't know who was more disappointed, him or his wife.
Well, I think he was disappointed. But see, I think his wife knows more than him, or she has more nefarious plans than him or something like that. But the Council of Nine there, I don't think they're interested in money. I don't think that has anything to do with their motives at all. And so,
I don't know.
Tom's
been living off the dividends from the, you know, stock crash of 29 for quite a while.
So. Yeah, but as far as this goes, it's for something else. I think they have other plans for it. So I think that's kind of what she's
for the zero matter
at.
Specifically. Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah, got so it. It has nothing to do with money, you know, and then whatever she's getting that pen for, the pen must have been pretty important. Well, it's obviously pretty important if, you know, she was stealing it, but what's she going to do with it? I mean, it's just a pen.
Right, but who is she stealing it for is the question. So is she stealing it from that group, or is she stealing it back for that group? Is she in cahoots with the council, or is she opposed to the council? Again, if she does work with Leviathan, and that's the, you know, the kind of Russian organization, would be a rival to Hydra. So I don't know. I feel like we haven't heard the last of this because,
oh, not at all.
Thompson, who proves himself as completely incompetent and as incapable as ever in running S.H.I.E.L.D. I mean, I loved his speech. I do have to say, I loved him talking about how you and your commie buddies killed the carrot and, you know, insinuating that he's just a big stick. And that's really all he is. He's kind of just a big, dumb stick. He then gets his talking to by by Vernon Masters, who's Butthead.
Okay, I'm laughing because that's exactly what I have written in my notes for that character.
For the longest time, he was the bad guy from RoboCop. And then from after the 70s show, it's like, I can't see anything but red.
He was never the president from Star Trek? President of Starfleet or whatever he was?
Yeah. When I see him, I go, oh, yeah, he is the president of Starfleet from, what, Star Trek VI, I guess? But
yeah, something like that.
Too much makeup and stuff. Anyway, he has this talk with Thompson, and maybe it's just a different place that I'm coming from, but last year on Agent Carter, I really never could believe who was saying anything on the show, right? Because I didn't know whose loyalties were where. But, and maybe this is my interpretation now, or maybe the show is just doing a better job of laying this all out, but reading between the lines, this head of the FBI is actually a member of or in league with the Council of Nine and is trying to recruit Thompson into joining the organization that will become Hydra, because he's talking about the dissolution of SSR already. And so I'm sure that he's trying to help place certain people in whatever that new organization will be, which we know is S.H.I.E.L.D., which will be showing up here probably, you know, if not at the end of this season, whenever Agent Carter decides to end its run, I would assume that would end with the formation of S.H.I.E.L.D. But
So I, not knowing that they were called the Council of Nine when I saw it, did you happen to count how many members were there when they were meeting with?
No, I did not go back and do that, but it did seem like when Chadwick comes in that there would have been nine.
Okay.
I mean, there were, you know, I can kind of picture in my head. There could have been five guys on the left side of the table and there were three guys on the other side, and then Chadwick sat down in the empty spot. So I'm going to assume that there were nine.
If Red, the FBI agent, if he is a member of this, then he's going to have to explain to Thompson that one of the standards for being part of Hydra is that you have to have asthma, or I guess you can't blow very hard or something, because you have to put out candles with your fingers. But, you know, it's the old birthday candle gag trick solution there. Just
yeah, that's got to be horrible. Spitting
more symbolic. Bad guys can't blow out candles. Just remember that in case you're ever trapped.
Yeah. So Thompson, to me, and last season he was very much a follower, and even though he's in charge, he still seems very much of a follower in this, obviously much more concerned with his ego than the future of the SSR. You know, he feels that, you know, because he's a guy, he can help interrogate, or that, you know, that he can completely take care of the interrogation of Dottie, even though, you know, if he's paying attention, he would be seeing all these kind of warning signs that, you know, he's not equipped for the job.
Yeah, and I think they established his character last year as being pretty much a, you know, male chauvinist kind of guy that just doesn't quite get it. You thought he was going to maybe understand in one of the episodes when he kind of opened up about his past in the war. But, I mean, he's clearly, this is just his nature, you know, is to act like kind of arrogant, you know. I guess not even kind of, definitely arrogant about his abilities.
His character is probably the, what do I want to say, the reflection of the men of the time.
Oh,
right,
for
so
sure.
He is stereotypical of that. I would assume that if he comes to meet Wilkes at some point, he probably is a bigot as well.
I would guess so. Yeah, I mean that would fit that type of character, and if I imagine that they're going to all get out there to L.A. to see what's happening, and I think that's probably where Dottie Underwood's going to end up as well. So everybody's going to converge in a warmer climate.
Well, yeah, because Dottie is now in quote custody of the FBI. I feel that she may not be in custody very much longer. So we'll see what happens with that. So Peggy ends up going out to Los Angeles to work with Chief Sousa, who is head of that department. We don't see too many of his agents. I think there's really only like two guys that we see. It makes it feel like very much of a sketchy department that he's got out there.
Well, yeah, I got the impression that they sort of threw something together out there because they wanted it, but they don't have much support and they don't have many people that are even reporting to him. I'm not even sure that they take his department seriously, probably.
Well, I also thought it was cool that for whatever, you know, day of the week it was, he was wearing pretty casual Aloha shirt with a jacket. So that's a little more relaxed than the folks back east.
Well, it is L.A., you know.
They were having a heat wave. Yeah, I understand. I mean, people can dress, you know, normally or, you know, professionally out in L.A. as well. We got Rose, who went out with him, which I think is funny is that Thompson made a joke to Sousa about surfing when he talked to him on the phone, which it's just insensitive, right? I mean, you know, Sousa's has the crutch and everything like that, and Thompson's just he's just an ass about it. But we find out later that Rose is actually the one that's taken up surfing, and she's actually arguing with somebody. I think it was Violet about the best beach to catch the waves at, or specific types of waves or something like that. So I thought that was really interesting because I think we only saw her in that first episode last year. Maybe we saw her in one other episode.
I think
Peggy
she
was coming
in,
through.
In the, yeah, as they walked by or something, a couple little times for just a
but
half
that's
a
it.
Second.
That was it, right?
Yeah, that was it. But apparently people liked her. They were satisfied with her performance there, so.
Yeah, well, I mean, I knew fans really liked her because she was, you know, the one that commented to Peggy in that first episode, you know, love the hat. And that was in a lot of the promos, and I've seen that quote used with different pieces of Agent Carter art that fans have done, you know, online and things like that. So, you know, she seems like a really nice and interesting character, and I'm glad we get to see a little bit more about her.
They need to give her some more little, maybe a couple more lines like that this season. Some memorable standout slogan type lines. You know, that would be that would be fun for her to be the source of that kind of thing.
Cookie. That was a good
there you
one.
Go. That wasn't too bad. Yeah.
Yeah. So so Peggy comes out, and there's some. Palpable sexual tension between her and Sousa, but we find out that probably was not meant to be, as Sousa has a offline earlier you called her fiance, but I guess she's soon to be fiance, like a very serious girlfriend.
Oh, right, because he hadn't asked her
because he's
yet,
looking
he?
To he's looking to pop the question, I guess, which seems to upset Peggy, but you know, stiff upper lip and all that with the British, she kind of holds on to her composure and, you know, really wishes him well. And I feel that she's not just saying that she wishes him well, that she really is happy for him, that he's found somebody. But, you know, there also seem to be some elements that maybe Sousa's not sure that he made the right decision. But what did he say? Something about the time. The three-hour time difference seems like a lifetime or something along those lines.
Yeah.
It's just, you know,
man,
it's hard to have a long-distance relationship, especially at that period of time.
It is over the 4-ish years that I have been recording with you, I've noticed more and more that the love life of superheroes is extraordinarily complex. More so than I ever really realized reading just comic books, but I think this is one of it's like they're determined, not determined, but they're destined to never be happy in their
it's
love
like
life.
It's like someone was like messing with them on purpose. Weird.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, they just they don't open up with their feelings enough, and they drag their feet, and then it's too late. So, but you know, I mean, realistically, I think that's probably what Sousa would do, especially in an era of our history where people expected you to get married, you know, especially at a certain age. And he was out there. He had someone to smooch on, and so why not marry her? Oh, man, what? Ah, the one I really love just came into town? Dang it.
Yeah. Gosh darn it. there was one other... I was just going to add, just speaking about with the time difference, the other thing that I thought was really interesting, just to really point out that we are in a different time, like that just the people live in an entirely different way. When they show Peggy flying from New York out to L.A., it's not just one line, you know, like Indiana Jones going, you know, straight through to L.A. It's like she flies to Kentucky and then up to Montana and then down to Los Angeles or whatever. It was like a three stop. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's totally how that would have worked back in the 40s.
Yeah. And plus, you know, it was cheaper on Expedia that, you know, when she got her ticket. So she had to make a few layovers. But
what's is that like the exchange that they call XPDA?
Yeah, that's
something like that.
that is interesting. I didn't even think about that when I was watching that, but no.
Yeah, just I mean, filmically, they had those. Like, I'm assuming they're from the 40s, but they had color shots of Los Angeles from, you know, that era that they had in a square format. Now, of course, most of us are watching this in a kind of a widescreen or 16:9 format on our televisions or on our computer screens. I don't know if you noticed, but they transitioned from the square 4:3 format of those old Hollywood, film footage to the new footage of Sousa pulling up in his car. It was still in a 4:3 format, but as he pulls his car into the frame, the black bars on the sides of your television set expand, and then all of a sudden we are in a full frame of our TV show.
I did notice that. I thought that was a great transition.
It it really took you from that kind of travelogue footage into the show. Also very much like the way that they worked on when Whitney Frost was doing her scenes, they had dust and scratches and stuff running through the film as we're seeing the scene that she's shooting. Now, I would have thought it would have been better if they had actually put that in black and white and then transitioned out of it back into color when the director yelled cut. But that's that's kind of a personal choice for all that. So really, really cool things that they're doing with the lighting and the design of the show and the look of the show to kind of give it that period feel.
Yeah, they're really paying attention to those details, which I think is probably why I feel it's so so much more natural.
So we got a bunch of new characters on the show this season. I just kind of want to run down through these characters. Why don't you? I'll mention who they are, and you just give me your thoughts on them. We've touched on a couple of these characters mm-hmm. already, but we've got Calvin Chadwick, the politician and president or CEO of Aes Sedaine, and his movie actress / physicist wife, Whitney Frost. So tell me a little bit what you think about those characters.
Liking these characters, at first it felt like Chadwick was going to be kind of the strong arm bad guy here. And as he progressed, it turns out he's really just kind of a minor player in a bigger game. But I do think that his wife is a bigger player than I originally expected her to be. And I mean, clearly there's going to be more happening now. Mm-hmm. But I think she's going to play a more important role than him. He ends up being kind of the peon guy. You know, I think even she's controlling him in the marriage.
Yeah, well, I love the scene where she's yelling at him. She's like, why didn't you stand up to the council and, you know, have them do what you wanted? Mm-hmm. And she's screaming at him, and I'm like, yeah, because you're screaming at him and getting him to do what he wants. He just caves. I mean, that's...
Yep.
that's his... the way that he is, I guess. So, Yeah, Whitney Frost is a name that is familiar or might be familiar to fans of Marvel Comics. In the comic books, she's not a 1940s character. She's a modern character called Madame Mask. Most recently seen in the Hawkeye series by Matt Fraction, which was out a couple years ago. She was in Los Angeles dealing with the female Hawkeye character. So I'm interested to see what they do with kind of a 1940s spin on this supervillain. Might be too strong a word, but I don't know. She's, you know, it's kind of an origin story for her. So we'll see where that goes. We've got a new character, Dr. Jason Wilkes, African-American character on the show. I got to say, I love this actor. I don't recall seeing him in anything before, but he's instantly likable, and I wasn't sure that he, at least in the first episode, I wasn't sure that he was actually above board and a good guy. But with the second episode...
Are you sure now?
Kind of seeing... I am pretty sure. Just given the fact that he's a black man in this world, and the, you know, we got that little taste of the racism that still exists here in a post-war America, even before the 50s, you know, and all the bad stuff that we've heard about going on then, even though there were black men that had fought in the war and stuff like this, when they came back to America, you know, there was all sorts of problems with just, you know, average people. So I don't feel, I mean, he could be out for himself in some fashion. There could be something else going on there, but I think he's, I'm believing what he's saying so far, but
okay.
Maybe this is just a really good actor, because he's just so well, animated and funny.
I don't disagree with you. At first, I really thought there was something else going on, really mainly because just he worked at Isodyne and he was doing, you know, experiments and
science and stuff,
learning
yeah.
all the stuff that they were doing there. But I mean, he helped her so much, and he really kind of put a lot out there to do things that could have really affected his future. And even got
right.
him thrown in jail and things like that. By the end, I guess I agree with you. I think he's probably on the level. Well, at least he was, right? No longer with us, right?
Yeah, he's just a spot on a ceiling somewhere now, supposedly.
Oh, and the wall.
And the floor. So, it seems like the actor is going to be in a few more episodes, according to his IMDb information. But, you know, they sometimes just say that just to throw people off. And then other times they don't.
All right, we'll see. If he does come back, it'll be interesting to see how. So even if we really believe that he's going to come back, it'll be really interesting to see how they bring him back. Because that'll explain a little bit more about what the Zero Matter is doing.
Right. I mean, we really are not completely sure of what happened there at the end. I'll get into that in a little bit. I got some questions to go there. We finally get to... I got to be honest. I did not think we were ever going to meet this next character, because I thought they were going to just have it as the character that always gets talked about and is just off screen, but that we never get to see. And that's Jarvis's wife, Anna.
Yep.
We found out some great stories about her last year, and there was some revisitation, her telling of the events briefly of how she and Jarvis met, but she and Peggy becoming like fast friends, and really no inkling of any kind of suspicious looks between her and Peggy when she catches Peggy and Jarvis, you know, quote unquote wrestling out on the veranda. She knows that Jarvis loves her, and that there, you know, there's no funny business or anything like that. I don't know a woman like that. I don't think.
I don't either. Too bad. But I was surprised that they brought her in. But man, did I really like her. How fun she is. I mean, she's like I almost want to say she's like Jarvis's sidekick. You know, I mean, like Jarvis is Peggy's sidekick, but she's like the other sidekick. But she's kind of not even the brains of the operation. It's almost like they're just a good team. But I think
she's like Robin's Robin.
I think that they probably brought her in because they needed somebody to talk to Peggy about things like they were talking about, you know, like the personal stuff. Yeah. In those scenes, similar to the way that her waitress friend was doing that last season. I was trying to look back on my old notes to see what her name was. I can't think of her name, but so I think that gave them a reason to, you know, to use somebody to talk to Peggy, woman to woman, you know, because she's really just around men most of the time.
Yeah. And having some more regular female characters on the series, I mean, bringing Rose out, and having Anna there, there's obviously, you know, Whitney's on the show, Dottie's on the show, but they're antagonists. So there's not going to be any, I mean, there's going to be parallels and connections, but not character moments where they're, you know, talking about.
Right. And that's important if you're going to have a good storyline. You got to have those character moments.
Well, and so, since it's a story and a TV show about a strong female character, you have to put in some, well, you don't have to, I guess, but they have put in other strong female characters that are as confident in their femininity and themselves as any of the other men are, and probably as equal as Peggy is. I mean, Anna may not be as skilled as Peggy, you know, in fighting or something like that, but she knows who she is. I think she knows her worth and value and everything like that in the same way that Peggy does.
Yeah. Yeah. Liked her a lot. I can't wait to see more of her.
We've also got Violet, who is Sousa's girlfriend / almost fiance, depending on how that goes down. And so she and Peggy got off to a great start. She and Rose seem like they're good friends. So there's yet another strong character that, she can interact with and that can add value for the you know, other characters on the show.
I don't know what's going to happen to Violet, but I don't anticipate that she's going to have much of a happy ending. At the worst, she might get killed. At the best, I don't think she's going to be marrying Daniel. I don't think they're going to end up together.
There was one scene I got a weird vibe off of her.
Yep,
it was at the one where she was. Where she met him with the bear claw.
Yes, that was it.
They shot it with a long lens, so they were like three doors down, and it seemed really intimate because we were so zoomed in, but there was something just kind of creepy about that, and I'm like, I'm seriously getting a Dottie Underwood vibe from her.
Ooh.
And,
scary.
You know, because like she's a nurse, it's like, you know, oh, she's a nurse in Los Angeles and post-war, it's like, but she's dating, you know, it's like he's only been out there, you know, at most maybe a year, but let's say 4 months. They've progressed pretty quickly in their relationship, and she seems almost too perfect.
Hey, now, remember what happened with Jarvis and his wife? That happened very quickly, too, you know.
That is true. That is true. Entirely different situation, but I don't discount that. I mean.
The heart wants. Something weird. I think also part of it, you know, the short time and that kind of weird thing you said. I think Daniel knows it too. I think Daniel knows that she's not really his soulmate or whatever you want to say about her. He loves her, I think, just fine, and he would have been fine marrying her. But now that Peggy's here, I think he realizes it's not what it's supposed to be.
Yeah. I think that's a good way
poor
to put it.
Poor Violet. Well, maybe poor Violet, unless, you know, she's a crazy Russian nurse or something like that. Dottie Underwood. Yeah.
And then we've got Vernon Masters, head of the FBI. New character there. As we discussed, he seems enthralled in some fashion with the Council of Nine. So we'll see what happens there. So let me just see if I can kind of sum up what the mystery elements are so far. We know there's this. We didn't know what it was to start with because of the Frozen Lady and stuff, but there's this this zero matter stuff that was discovered by accident when a nuclear test was done by Aes Sedain a few years prior, and they were able to save this stuff, which is also very similar to how the obelisk in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is when it kind of becomes liquid. I mean, there seems to be a little bit of an element to that as well. I don't think they're supposed to be related other than just that they're kind of evil, dark-looking.
You don't think so? Or something like that. I think there's some kind of relation. They just looked way too similar, and we have that symbol on the pin. I think they're related somehow. That's just my personal opinion.
I feel that the obelisk is definitely alien in origin, you know, due to the fact that it transports people to planets and stuff like that.
Right.
But the footage that we saw, you know, shows this weird, I mean, literally there's a rend in space-time, like a tear in the fabric of the universe. So as I think Jason Wilkes said, this object, the zero matter, the dark matter, whatever it is, could be extra-dimensional. So it could actually be coming from another dimension rather than from an alien origin or extraterrestrial. Hmm. That's, I mean, it sounds like it might be like, you know, six of one, half a dozen of the other, but I feel there's a...
No, it's different.
Separation,
I mean,
there. Yeah.
And I'm with you on that. I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me, especially since I do think, you know, they're setting up things for the Doctor Strange movie. But... yeah, it looks and feels so similar to the obelisk that they've been, you know, dealing with on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So,
yeah. And I think that's just, I think that's intended, but I don't think it's supposed to be the same.
Okay.
So, all right. We'll see. So, okay. So Calvin Chadwick has his dalliance with Jane Scott at the office, like happens, and she in some fashion gets exposed to this zero matter. So Detective Henry stages the whole thing to look like the Lady in the Lake killer has returned. But he too gets infected and gets killed by a police officer who is working for the group. Or for Calvin Chadwick or the Council of Nine, you know, is just another one of the people that's in the pocket of this large conspiratorial organization. Then, as I mentioned earlier, Vernon Masters, who appears to have ties as well, is recruiting Thompson. When we get to the council meeting, Hugh Jones, who, thank you for pointing this out to me or reminding me of this, he is the Roxxon oil president that we saw in the first couple episodes last season, when the nitramine explosion happened and turned Roxxon oil into a big smoking crater. He's there with a guy named Tom, and they, you know, are talking like two politically inbred white men that, you know, made a lot of money off the stock crash in 1929. And they're part of this secret group, the Society or the Council of Nine, along with Calvin Chadwick. And then Jane Scott's body ends up being stolen by yet someone else who also heads after Carter and Wilkes. So some random hood and his group. We don't really find out too much about them. But then there's also, as you mentioned, Whitney Frost seems to be behind, you know, the woman behind Calvin that's really kind of pulling the strings on a lot of this stuff. And she and Wilkes kind of blow up at the end. But we find that she is still alive, but now there's a black line on the side of her face. And is she infected in the same way that Jane Scott was, or is the zero matter inside of her in some fashion? Has she been recreated from the zero matter? What What are we supposed to infer by that?
She just needs more lighting and get makeup in here. Help her out a little bit.
Oh, okay. Yeah, she's pretty old.
To me, I felt as if she had been infected in some way. Now, we don't know what it's like for somebody that has just been infected, because we saw them in the original woman, you know, she was already frozen and dead. The cop, I'm assuming, had been infected for quite a while, and we don't know how it affected him other than the very end. So maybe that's just part of the infection, or maybe it's worse because of the manner in which she was infected. I noticed, you know, Peggy said something at the beginning when they kind of realized that she, that dead woman had been infected, or no, it was right after the cop had died. They were said, well, we've all been exposed, so we're all infected already, if that's the case. But they didn't really worry about that much, too much from then.
The follow-up line to that, I believe, was from Wilkes, and he says, it really could only happen if you were exposed to infected blood.
Oh, which is why the coroner...
Which is why the coroner was infected, which is why potentially Detective Henry got infected, but why everybody else seemed to be okay.
Oh, okay. All right. So
it was a really quick follow-up, but
I guess I missed that.
That covers it, yeah.
So they don't have to worry about that. So we don't really know exactly what's going to happen to her, because we didn't see any of the origins of the other people. So I think she's infected. I think it's, like you said, inside of her or something like that. But that it's going to, because it exploded instead of just touching it or breathing it or whatever they did, it's going to give her some kind of ability.
And do you think that Wilkes is also infected and we just haven't seen what happened to him? And if so, would he have some similar abilities then?
Possibly. Now that you say that, that makes a lot more sense than what I was thinking if he shows up in the next episode. But to me, I almost thought maybe he got sucked into it like we saw in the film, you know, how they had shown the test footage, that maybe he got sucked up into it, almost a la, you know, Simmons, Agent Simmons from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I'm not sure. Now that you say that, maybe he did. Maybe he did disappear in some way and is lying behind some bush, realizing he's got new spiky skin or invisible powers or something. I don't know.
Okay. Interesting. So
that was a very, very, very informed speculation, but you got me thinking there right at the end. So
I was going to say, sometimes your uninformed speculations are more spot on than you know, your subconscious is already working on it.
Thank you. That's why I try never to pay attention. So,
I even more so than last season, these episodes are really about strong women that men continue to underestimate. Dottie, Peggy, definitely. Whitney is you know, everybody thinks that she's this Hollywood star, a fading star probably because of her age and stuff like this. But obviously, there's a lot more going on with her. So I am much more excited about the continuation of this season than I was for season one. If I recall, season one, I felt like it took a while for them to kind of connect the dots or have other characters connect the dots on things that we had figured out, you know, on the second or third episode. And it made me question, like, well, maybe that's not really what's going on. But it ended up being, yes, that was what was going on. And just they spread it out over 8 episodes. Given the format of, like, the Netflix series from Marvel, which are 13 episodes, and this being a 10-episode arc, I feel like they have a little bit more time that they probably will tell a slightly larger story. I felt like season one told a story that kind of had to be stretched to 8 episodes. Hopefully this season will be a story that is almost contained by 10 episodes. I would rather have it feel like they had to take some stuff off than stretch stuff out to fill the time they've got. So
I'm with you. I'm with you. If this is the main storyline with what's going on here in the first couple episodes, then you know, make it a good one, make it have some important stuff. And I think they've got a lot of potential in there because you got Dottie Underwood with this pen that can show up later on to make the connection why she was in New York and what she was doing. But like you said, in the first season, it started off with something quite a bit different than what it ended up with. It's almost like she kind of stumbled upon what the main thing was with her first.
But a few episodes adventure. Later.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was a lot of learning and stuff going on with that. So I would be happy if, you know, they could keep the Zero Matter stuff going through the entire season. They could wrap it up in episode 4 or 5. But as long as it feels like we're organically moving on to something else that this council is working with, or Whitney Frost all of a sudden becomes more of a antagonist for the characters, you know, everything should feel a little bit organic as it stems off from that. So we'll see where they go. New episode next week, so we will definitely be covering that. A few references I did want to point out. Nothing super tied into the comic books. I kind of gave my take on Whitney Frost already. When Peggy first gets out of the car to go into the Auerbach talent agency, there is a movie marquee behind her that says Whitney Frost in Tales of Suspense, which was also mentioned by Jarvis at the racetrack that when he points out Whitney Frost to Peggy Carter. Tales of Suspense is a comic book from Marvel Comics that was originally published by Atlas Comics in the 50s and turned into the book that introduced Iron Man and Doctor Strange to readers. And then I think it had the Hulk in it towards the end of its run. And then actually, I think it just the numbering turned into the Hulk magazine at some part. As you had pointed out, the title of the first episode was The Lady in the Lake, which is a part of the Arthurian legend. That is the woman that gave King Arthur his magical sword, yes. Excalibur.
Her arm in pure shimmering samite held aloft Excalibur from the bosom of the water and declared by divine providence that he, Arthur, should become king. That one?
Just because some watery tart, you know, threw a blade from the water. That doesn't mean that he's entitled to, you know, the throne of England. But
yeah, well, hey, Monty Python's where I get most of my Arthurian legends. There, so.
And then the second episode, A View in the Dark, sounded to me a little bit like a take on A Shot in the Dark, which is an Inspector Clouseau film, but also that there's this kind of dark matter. So I don't know that I'm not really sure where the connection really is there, but that was just kind of what I thought. And then I also thought that the East Coast and West Coast offices of the SSR were very much like the Avengers had a West Coast Avengers team for a while. So, you know, little split there. The SSR and S.H.I.E.L.D. is closely tied to the Avengers and the Avengers Initiative. So that's kind of tied together for me there. So those were some of the things that that I saw here. But, you know, I think for now, Josh, that we've quite exceeded our normal time limit, though this was a 2-for-1 special. But I feel that that's about all we've got for this week's episode of Agent Carter of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files.
Well, I hope you guys enjoyed listening to us talk about it and getting into Season 2. If you did, please leave us some feedback on iTunes. We would love to hear it. Or if you want to contact us about any of these Agent Carter episodes as we go through it, or Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. as well, you can get us by email. Our email address is shield@randomchatter.com. You can also visit Twitter, find us there, @AgentsPodcast, and go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/AgentsPodcast.
You can also check out the other shows that Josh and I host, including Green Justice, an Arrow podcast, and Scarlet Velocity, a Flash podcast, via randomchatter.com, and on our newest partner, forcecast.net, on their Outer Rim network. All shows are also available in the iTunes Store and through Stitcher for Android or iOS. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please be sure to tell your friends about us. So if you're enjoying Agent Carter and you like listening to Agent Carter of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files, we'd like you to tell your friends about us so they can enjoy us too. So for Agent Carter of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files, this is Jay.
And this is Josh.
Until next week, bidding you adios, auf Wiedersehen, aloha.
This podcast is not endorsed by ABC Television or Marvel Entertainment. The official website for Marvel's Agent Carter can be found at abc.go.com. Agent Carter and related elements are copyright Marvel Entertainment, LLC.